Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, I'm Jason, and I support Gen X Grown Up on Patreon. You should do the same, because the world just needs more GXG to make it a better place. Just go to genxgrownup.com/Patreon to donate to the cause.
No life, no fun. Don't you know that you're a grown-up?
Gen X Grown Up is a YouTube channel, website, and audio podcast you're listening to right now. All made for and by people who love exploring media, games, tech, and toys of yesterday and today through the eyes of Gen Xers who refuse to grow up.
Your dinner cannot just be french fries. Basically, life sucks as a grown-up.
Welcome back, Gen X Grown Up podcast listeners, to this, the backtrack edition of the Gen X Grown Up podcast. I am John. Joining me, as always, of course, is George.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Wouldn't be a show without Mo. Hey, man.
Hey, everybody.
You know, four decades ago, just when video games seemed to be the next big thing, the bottom dropped out. Compounding problems like market confusion, consumer confidence, and game quality, to name just a few, nearly demolished a seemingly unstoppable new industry. They ultimately made a comeback, but the future looked bleak when the video game crash of 83 swept through North America. That's just ahead in this backtrack edition of this show. Before we get to that, and there's so much to get to, so stick around. And it's time for some fourth listener email. And this time around, our fourth listener is John V, who dropped us a line in our inbox. Subject of his email is Star Wars Trivial Pursuit.
No, like it already.
Our backtrack. Like it already. There you go, Mo. Mm-hmm. So this is a great email. I almost didn't do any editing, so forgive me. This is a long. Here we go. John says, on a cool spring day in 1999, our core of four was camped outside of the Hollywood Theater in Appleton, Wisconsin, with others waiting overnight to buy tickets for the opening showing of The Phantom Menace.
Very cool.
You don't find this camaraderie buying tickets online today.
No,
nope. No tent set up down the street. None of that stuff we used to do. He says, to pass time, someone brought Star Wars Trivial Pursuit, and the rules of acceptable alternative answers was invoked. Mm-hmm. For example, if the correct answer to a question was blaster, saying gun was not acceptable. However, if the correct answer was Lando Calrissian, an answer of Colt 45 was not only acceptable, but encouraged.
Okay, I get it. That's cool. I like that.
All right, we get you. Over the years, our movie-going group would expand and contract, but the core of four was there for every Star Wars movie opening through the Rise of Skywalker.
Wow.
This past summer, one of our core, Gary, a friend of 27 years, passed away unexpectedly in his early 50s.
Mm.
Looking at my own copy of Star Wars Trivial Pursuit brings back good memories. And he caps off this email with words to live by. John, very well written. He says, play all the games, spend all the time, enjoy all your friends. John, poignant, to the point, well said. I don't have anything to add. You're right. You're absolutely right.
End of the episode. I'm good to go.
Bye-bye, everybody. Yeah, I'm John.
Thank you. Yeah, nothing to add.
John, that's exactly the feeling that we all have, that feeling of nostalgia, old friends. You can't make new old friends, as the saying goes, right? Those people. And we're all getting that age. We're starting to lose some of the people we care most about.
Yeah.
So live it while you got it, right? I mean, kidding. Thank you so much, John, so much for writing in. We appreciate your email.
Awesome.
We appreciate every time one of our fourth listeners takes the time to write in. If you would like your email featured here on the show, it is drop dead easy. Just hit us up at podcast@genxgrownup.com. Read them all. And eventually, it'll probably make an episode just like John's. Okay. With that good business behind us, it is time to jump into the body of the 1983 video game crash right after this.
In a world infatuated with comic fandom, comes a show to help us remember the talents that have inspired us.
Whoa, 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 cut.
Oh, come on. It wasn't that bad.
It's a bit dramatic. Let's just tell them about the show, guys.
We are the Canned Air Podcast.
Join us weekly for a comedic trip through pop culture.
We also welcome some cool comic creators, as well as some of the voice and screen actors that helped shape your childhood.
Find us on CannedAirPodcast.com and on the Evergreen Podcast Network.
You're listening to Gen X Grown Up. But if you have a friend who's not yet listening, why not? Tell them about us. They'll thank you later.
Enter the imagination of Atari, the imagination that brings you the world's most popular video games, like Dig Dug, where you make your own maze, then have to deal with it, Kangaroo, where you have to save the baby from ferocious monkeys, and Sorcerer's Apprentice, where the magic of Disney and Atari meet. Experience the challenges and the thrills that come only from the imagination of Atari.
The story of the 1983 video game market crash is a story like any other. It has a beginning, and it has a middle where the chaos took place, and it has a happy ending because, I mean, you're here with us in the present, and you know video games are not gone, right? They're not hula hoops.
Yep.
They're a big deal, right? But in order to get to that middle and to the happy ending, we have to start at the beginning, the rise of video games and the consoles. And I know, George, you did a bunch of digging into a lot of the numbers and the rise of that. So why don't you start by sharing that bit of that with us?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a lot out there, and depending upon where you look, of course, you're going to maybe come across slightly different numbers. So take our numbers with a grain of salt. I found them in a couple of different places that I feel were reliable, but, you know, I could be completely off in this day and age. However, what we're talking about are the first gen consoles. These are game systems that came out in 1972. Now, remember, this is before cartridges, right? These are whole systems that did a specific thing. So you're talking about things like the Magnavox Odyssey, which came out in 72, that had 367,000 units sold at $100 a pop. Wow. In 72 to 79.
Oh my gosh.
You're talking about like Coleco. They came out with their first one called the Telstar. These are all Pong style things. Magnavox also came out with the Odyssey 100 and 200, another 100,000 each on those. Nintendo, believe it or not, way back in 1972 had a console called the Shooting Gallery that they released. So this is one of their first forays. Only did 20,000 units. That's why you never heard of it, but it was there.
Okay.
One of the big ones, and arguably, I think you're going to say that somebody copied somebody, and I'm not going to say who or why or how, but Pong was the game. And you had one from Sears called the Telegames Pong and one from Atari called Home Pong.
Oh, yeah.
Sears, given the fact that they had their own retail stores, kicked Atari's ass. 150,000 to 50,000 units sold. What you're talking about is this first generation, this thing that gets people's juices flowing for gaming at home that's not on a board or with some dice or with some cards. This is on your television, whatever form that took. There were some other little things, like I found this one, 16,000 called Name of the Game. I'm only throwing that out there because there's going to be one of our listeners going, you didn't talk about
Allied thing, right?
From Allied System. Anyway, lots of good stuff in that first gen, but it's not the first gen that we really focus on when we're talking about the crash.
Yeah.
It's really the second gen, right? Because
the first gen laid the groundwork so that it was an industry in the first place.
Right.
Exactly.
And then like consumers were like, well, this is cool. What else you got?
Right. Exactly. What you're talking about here are that first wave of cartridge-based systems. Granddaddy of them all, largest seller. I don't know. Maybe it's the largest seller of any console of all time. I remember hearing that at some point. I know the Commodore 64 and the PC section was that for a long time. The Atari VCS / 2600, whatever you want to call it, released in 1977, up until the point when they stopped counting, 25 million units sold. Now, how many units of those have been resold since then? Probably hundreds of millions.
Right.
Point.
Triple that.
I know I bought two or three off of eBay.
Yep, me too.
Still, wow.
You've also got some really solid contenders that some argue are better than the Atari VCS. ColecoVision, 6 million of those units. Intellivision, released in 1979, 3 million of those.
That was a big one. I remember that.
Yeah.
One of my personal favorites that I had, it was a gift given to my father for winning some contest at his grocery store.
Yep.
The Magnavox Odyssey 2, 2 million of those units went out there. John, I think you like this console a little bit, the Atari 5200, which came out obviously after the 2600.
Yeah, and like I always wanted one.
Another million of those units.
I didn't get one until last year.
Right.
It's the first time I actually owned one that I finally got because it was basically the same chipset as my beloved Atari 8-bit computer, and I knew how good those games games were. Mm-hmm. But I'm looking at your stats here. The 2600 sold 25 million units, yeah. 1 million units.
Right.
And that was in 82, the year mm-hmm. right before the bubble burst. It's starting to make sense.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah, right. That's when we're getting to that time frame.
Mm-hmm.
Then what I think, I've seen enough of those Games That Made America kind of segment documentary things to talk about this in somewhat of a knowledgeable fashion. Fairchild Channel F from mm-hmm. Fairchild yep. only did 350,000 units, but most agree that it was the first yep. cartridge system.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how its cartridges got the games on your screen leaves a little bit of argument there based on the 2600 and ColecoVision, so on and so forth. But most people agree that that was the very first system, and yet it was the least selling of yeah. all the second gen systems, which is why Fairchild didn't really last.
So we almost didn't hear about them until we started looking right. back at gaming history. And then you're like, oh, yeah, I never heard yeah. of it. And like they were the progenitor of the idea of swappable games. And that swappable game idea is going to be a recurring theme when you can start printing just software mm-hmm. to go with these consoles. That's where this bubble starts to get bigger and bigger and leading toward yeah. that bursting point.
100%. And truthfully, I kind of want to ask a question before I get into this next little part before yep. we move out of this segment. Of that list of the second gen consoles, not the first gen, because only Mo was old enough to own the
John
first
owned
gen.
One.
But
it's 26.
No, he didn't.
Yeah, I had the Telegames Pong. I had that one. That was the one I got that okay, I took back right. to the store to get my 2600 actually.
Oh, you took it back.
That's right.
See, anyway. But you took it back. So
you're right.
That's right.
It
wasn't the best.
Of the second gen consoles, we've already mentioned that I had the Odyssey 2. Did you guys have more than one on that list, and what were they? John, start with you.
I only ever had the Atari 2600 on that list. I coveted wow. the rest.
Okay.
I was dying for a ColecoVision. I was dying for a 5200. But I mean, back then, look, today, what game system do you have? Which one do you need? I've got an Xbox. I got a PS4. Right. I got a Switch, right? Back then, like it was like a water heater. It was like, you've already got a game system. Right. You don't need another game system. It was just a piece of hardware that parents thought it was like stereo equipment, right? Like, no, they're different.
And an expensive mm-hmm. piece
very
of hardware.
Expensive. Yeah.
That 5200 released it in 1982 at $270. That's like $900 today.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was happy to have what I had. I asked for the others, but never got them. I wanted them, but never got them. How about you, Mo?
Of all the ones on that list, the only one I owned, we had a Magnavox. We had an Odyssey 2.
Okay.
And the Atari. That's it. So those two.
No, I didn't have the Atari. I went to a friend's house to play Atari.
Oh, you didn't have one yourself? I forgot Mm-mm. that. That's right. You didn't have one yourself. Yep. Oh, okay. Yep.
Mm-hmm. My best friend had one, so we spent a lot of time there. But
George, what about you?
Well, so obviously I had the Odyssey 2 that I talked about. I did have the Atari VCS. I didn't have, although I wanted it, I didn't have the Intellivision. I played that at a friend's across the street house.
Mm-hmm.
I have one now, thanks to your generosity, but I didn't have one then. Never had the Fairchild, hadn't even heard of it. The ColecoVision I'd heard of, but didn't really have much of an interest because the Intellivision looked like the ColecoVision in a lot of ways. So I didn't know that they were different things at that age. I was still pretty young.
Because the Intellivision came out much earlier.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, let's get into the last part of all this research that I did. We get into the meat of the subject after that. I just pulled up a list of the top selling games on a lot of those coveted second gen systems, because I thought it was important to talk about the cartridges because we're talking about the game crash and the cartridges and the games have a lot to do with the game crash, maybe more so than the consoles.
Yeah.
First one, Atari VCS 2600, leading seller, 25 million units. What do you guys think was the number one cartridge without looking at the sheet? What do you think was the number one cartridge sold for that system?
I would have said something from Activision, like a Pitfall or something. Would have been my
I would say like Yars Revenge.
No. Yeah. Great game.
Yars Revenge, Pitfall. Great choices. Not even fucking close, ladies and gentlemen. $8 million. My Pac-Man cartridge. Yes, sir. The best game on the 2600.
Oh, God.
And 7 million were returned. No. Look, as much as I crap on that Pac-Man, when I had it, I loved it. Even though it wasn't right, it was Pac-Man as close as I could get it in my house, so I played it.
Mm-hmm. right, John, you've got this next one in the bag. ColecoVision, top-selling game on that system. You got to know what this one is.
Donkey Kong is what sold that system. It's got to be, everybody had that. Yeah, that's the cheapest cartridge to get because they made a million. Yeah.
How many? Absolutely.
2 million. 2 million. Oh, crap. Damn. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, remember, the ColecoVision had a smaller base than the VCS. So,
that's true. Yep.
Yeah. Good, solid system. In television, this one's going to throw you for a little bit of a loop. So you think of great games. You think of Pac-Man. You think of Donkey Kong. You think of Q-Bert. You think of Galaga, Galaxian, all those games. In television, nope. Las Vegas Poker and Blackjack, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, you know that was one of the launch titles. And I think I remember reading that it was one of the best of the like four or five launch titles they had. So I bet for the first few months, everybody bought that because that's all there was. That had to help them a lot.
Exactly.
Also, it came out in 79 before a lot of the arcade games came out even. You know, there was no Pac-Man.
Before the ports were happening. Yeah, yeah. That's true too. Yeah.
But still though,
so just a smidge under 2 million units.
Jeez.
So.
Okay.
John, had you had your 5200 that you coveted so much, you could have gotten Galaxian as the top selling cartridge of its day.
That makes sense. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think they packed Pac-Man into that, maybe. For Galaxian to win out, it had to be good. Yeah.
Now, I couldn't find any statistics on how many units, but it's listed on three different sites as the top selling
the
cartridge
one.
For that.
I mean,
system,
I believe that for sure.
Yeah.
Glasson was a popular game.
Fairchild Channel F. We all know how that system worked with its cartridges. Its cartridges were essentially just dip switches for the built-in games on the console. And the most popular built-in game on that console was hockey/tennis, which is essentially Pong, but with a cartridge now.
Yeah, Pong with two things that are just one on each side.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like you were buying an unlock key for the game that was really already in there. It's like modern DLC almost. It's like, oh, well, to play as this character, like, you know, I've already downloaded it. It just won't let me use it. Ahead of its time.
And then the final one, the unit that had sold the least amount at this point next to the Odyssey, the Magnavox Odyssey 2, had a game that I never owned, but now I kind of want to go get it. Pickaxe Pete / KC's Crazy Chase, all with K's.
Never heard of that.
Pickaxe Pete is good. That's the only game I ever played on it. Yeah, because it was...
Wow.
I forget. How do you describe it? It's kind of... It was the most Donkey Kong looking of the games on Magnavox, which is why I played it.
Gotcha.
But it was like a platformer, and your little guy was like... It was almost like a mashup between Pac-Man and Donkey Kong. Like, he was picking up dots or something. Maybe gold. I forget what he
did. Okay.
Yeah.
There you go. I mean, so... I took my time that I've had over the last few weeks and put together all those statistics because we needed to kind of set the stage.
That's right.
For the discussion, right?
See, we're talking big numbers here.
Yeah.
I mean, for the day, 100%.
Yeah.
And imagine if you're listening to this and your eyes are glazing over because we're naming all these platforms, we're naming all these games and all these dollars and all these amounts. You're the consumer in 1983. You are starting to feel what was happening to the general public, which, like, for Christ's sake, there's so many. How do I pick what to play and which one is good and is it going to be worth my money? All of that led up to, those are contributing causes. We get back from this break. We're going to talk about all those and what led to the inevitable crash of video games in 1983. So stick around.
Pit Pass Moto, sponsored by Moto America, is the show that keeps you up to speed on the latest in motorcycling and brings the biggest names in motorcycle racing right to you. From candid interviews with the top names in racing to providing insights into the trends and trendsetters driving the motorcycle industry, we have you covered. New episodes are available every Thursday at pitpassmoto.com and on your favorite podcast app. Ride on.
Be sure to subscribe to or follow Gen X Grown Up wherever you listen. And while you're there, rate and review the show too. It helps more than you know.
Not every great movie or great arcade game makes a great home video game. That's why when Mattel Electronics turned Tron into Tron Home Video Games, we made sure the excitement of Tron gameplay found its way into your home. You'll know it the moment you square off against a recognizer, if you last that long. Four great Tron games, two for Intellivision, two for Atari 2600. From Mattel Electronics, games as good as we say they are, maybe better.
Now, you will often heard it said, the video game crash of 1983, the video game crash of 1983. However, many people will say slow your roll there. This really just affected North America. And we've qualified it a few times already in this podcast. And that is kind of true. In fact, in Japan, it was called the Atari shock. They didn't call it a crash because it's like Atari over there in America, they had a problem. Because in Europe, all throughout Japan, they were still doing video games fine. I mean, they didn't have that big of a problem because they didn't have the commercial proliferation that we had here in North America. Now, what I will posit, and we'll see by the end of this episode, that while it didn't directly hit the other parts of the world, because of the impact it had on North America and the United States in general's economy, it had ripple effects around the world. And we have some stats to show that. So what do we mean by the crash? Let me put it in the most blunt terms possible. And this is something that I can't believe George didn't write this, or maybe he was about to, since I already put it in here. Here's the thing. The video game crash actually occurred between 82 and 85, though 83 is kind of where it started to really take its nosedive. Right. In 1982, the video game market was a $3.2 billion industry.
Mm-hmm.
By the end of 1985, the precipitous drop of 97% made it a $100 million industry. 97%! Wow. This was something that there's no end in sight. It's just a money way to print money. That's what Atari thought. That's what all these peripheral companies thought. That's what third-party devs thought. And they were wrong. And it nearly killed the industry.
Well, I mean, like you said, I mean, it was, everyone saw people making a ton of money. So everybody started jumping into the market, right? I mean, like you said, like you were talking, George, you had the Magnavox, you had the Fairchild that no one heard of, the Atari 2600, Television, ColecoVision, then they had like three versions of Ataris that came out, right? The 2600, 5200, 7800 eventually, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, no, every parent probably bought their child the wrong one, you know? It's like, I mean, you got me the Magnavox. I wanted this one, or, you know, I mean, it's
well, and they were all wrong for different reasons, right? Yeah. I mean, so if you got your kid the Atari 2600, that's wrong because how difficult was it to figure out what games to get from that point forward?
Because
there were
ridiculous.
So many games for that system, your kid was always going to want the thing you didn't buy. Yeah. If you got the ColecoVision, you didn't have the games available maybe that the kid wanted for the 2600. Same thing with all the others. You're right that it was always a wrong choice for every parent because they could only choose one. They didn't, their dollars didn't stretch the way that they could. And the systems were so disparate and were so localized that you could only use their things. It's not like today where the game gets released on 27 platforms all at the same time.
Yeah, with a few exceptions, but
yeah.
And you needed to get the one that your kids' friends had because they wanted to trade cartridges back and forth. And so I got to get the one little Joey up the street has. Yeah. So as we look at causes, I think three of these first three I want to talk about kind of are different facets of the same prism. The first is market saturation, which we just talked about. All these different platforms were coming out and it was confusing. So that leads us right into the next one, market confusion. So not only was there tons to pick from, it was hard. I mean, think about adults today, what are their kids like? You know, I don't know what Pokemon you like or what, you know, weird Nickelodeon show you, I don't know. And so parents were like, it was easy when it's just buy an Atari or don't. But when it was, there are 20 different things to pick from, it's confusing. So you're frustrated. And that led to the third facet, which is customer fatigue, meaning it didn't slow down. It's not like there was a big rush and then we leveled out. It was still climbing. You said it, Mo. More developers, like you had Activision and Imagic and US Games and all these people making stuff, making games, making new consoles, making new platforms, and enough already. You know, it just got to that point.
Yeah. Actually, that brings a point. Like George, like you kind of mentioned before, or you alluded to with the previous segment, you can only have one, right?
Yeah.
How many people had multiples of these? Because they said they were too expensive.
There's several reasons, by the way. It's not just the fact that these things cost a large amount of the average family's salary at the time. That's the first reason, right? Kid walks up, Mom, Dad, I want a 5200. That's $300. You're out of your little child mind. Go outside and throw a stick and have fun, right?
Throw rocks at your friends.
But there's another facet, too. What else did families not have multiples of in their homes at this point?
Televisions.
Yep, televisions.
Exactly.
Yep.
Yeah.
Right?
Place to plug it
in.
How
many systems are you going to hook up to one television? You're only going to hook up one system to that living room TV with those little screw things on the back and that converter.
With the two,
And if your parents also lived in an area which maybe was developing or had cable television, which was a new thing at this point as well, your parents were not going to give up the connections on the back of that TV for the cable television and your game console. So there was all kinds of, you know, ways that that had to be. And parents didn't want to figure that out for their child. They were just like, nope, screw you, Junior. You're going to wait or go play at a friend's house whose parents don't have cable or whatever.
That's why you had the hand-me-down black and white TV. That's why the Atari has a TV type switch, so you could play the games in black and white, because you probably didn't have the color. You had whatever they upgraded from. That's when you got to play your Atari or whatever on. Now, you kind of teed this one up earlier, George, when you're talking a little bit about the game quality. So think about this. Initially, you know who made games for the Fairchild?
Fairchild.
You know they made games for ColecoVision?
ColecoVision.
But in 1979, there's no such thing as a third-party developer. Didn't exist. Atari made games for Atari. That's all there was.
Right.
Nobody ever conceived that it would be any different.
Yeah.
But as we've talked about several times before in video and on podcast, Activision, the first third-party dev, was formed because they were fed up working for Atari. They weren't getting money for the successes. They weren't getting recognition. They weren't getting their credit. So they left four developers, Rockstar developers, by the way, to form Activision. That was in 79. By 1982, there were more than 30 third-party developers who said, oh crap, if they can do it, we can do it. There was nothing in the Atari that prevented anyone from doing that. And that was true of Intellivision and Coleco. All the platforms had never conceived that someone would make games. And you know what? They weren't all Activision. A lot of them were just making whatever they could make to get a quick buck, because they didn't care about the reputation of the console. They just needed to turn a profit.
Right.
One big point that you make in that, the four guys who left to form Activision were all Rockstar developers, right? The 700 guys that needed to be employed into these 30 companies to throw out the shovelware were not rock stars. These were like minor league talents at best. Why? Because this was a brand new industry that didn't have decades of training and development and systems where you have masters and apprentices learning how to do this stuff. Right now,
it's wave one.
We're in like fifth generation almost of game developers at this point. We're 50 years out. These guys, now it's more about developing how to build the better game more than we need talented people, because there's a billion talented people out there.
Huge workforce, right?
And I remember it's like some of those games that came out, like they would have these flashy boxes. They would have, they paid all the money was spent on the box and the cartridge, all that stuff. And then the games just like, were crap. I mean, just total crap. And then if you're a kid and you're spending, I mean, cartridges were not cheap back then. You know, they were like, what, $30
or something? $30, $35, something like that.
$35. Yeah. You spent your $35 that you had on a game and it blows. One, you're not going to play that game, and you're probably not going to play that system anymore.
Yeah. Or they would put it out at like $20. Like, look how cheap it is. And so you spend your $20 on that and it's super crap. So you might have been better off just throwing the money away. So discounts didn't even help because they weren't worth the $20.
Yep.
So let's say that you had $30 to spend in 1980. Do you know how much that is today? You know, we talk about
like
our
$100,
AAA games, 60. Yeah. $116 today.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
We lose our minds at 60 right now.
No, I know. I still lose my mind over that. Jeez.
Now Mo just pays it. He has a stack of AAA games he can't get through.
I'm pulling a George. I'm just going to buy it.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, the other thing we have to talk about, though, that this was also the beginning of the dawn of the home computer.
That's right.
Is when Atari came out with an awesome, you know, computer, right? IBM came out with their PC Junior, Radio Shack, the Trash 80, you know, Commodore 64, the VIC-20.
Yeah.
And they did more than just play games, right?
They were multi-use systems.
Right. So you could do many. So I think that's an easier sell to your parents. Like, oh, I could buy this and I could do my homework on it. Like, no one ever did. Right. But still, you could say you did.
That's what you said to get the computer. Right. Yeah.
Exactly.
But that was additional competition up against these consoles. It was like, not even other consoles. Now, just go buy a computer, forget about the console. There's another problem, right? Now, here's the thing. In 1982, this is right before, and you were talking about Galaxian, the 5200 was right before the bubble, George.
Right.
Now there's a flood of new companies. At this point, at least 50 different companies, later there were more, they produced between 1 and 2 million cartridges, plus Atari had produced about 60 million that year. Estimates said that amount of product was at least 200% of what the market was demanding, way beyond what they needed or wanted. So here they made all this, couldn't sell it, or they send it to stores, and the stores said, oh, you got to buy back this inventory, nobody wanted it. And right. Now the company started to get this log jam of like, well, wait a minute, how are we going to make new stuff when we got an inventory of 30 million cartridges that we couldn't get rid of last year? And welcome to 1983. And that's where it starts to percolate.
Yeah, there's one other factor though, and I think it's important to talk about it because it's the one that gets mentioned the least when we talk about this subject. When we talk about this subject, it's always, there's a bunch more systems out there. There's a bunch more developers out there. There's a flood in the market. People are confused. They don't know what to buy. Well, one reason why they weren't buying is because we were also going through a major recession in the late 70s and early 80s don't associate with the game crash, but it absolutely influenced and impacted this situation. You look at, we had the oil embargo, right, through the Carter administration. Remember the gas lines out in front? Young people aren't going to remember that, but we actually had to wait in line at gas pumps, not because of a natural disaster, but because somebody in a different country said, no, fuck you, you're not getting any more oil. Then we had Reagan, who was elected president in 1980, and he, you know, going to bring America and make it this great thing. But it took time for that economy to rebound. It wasn't probably really until his, like, the end of his first presidential session to the really into this second run that the economy really did the boom greed 1980s thing that we all know the 1980s for. The first third of that decade, we were in bad situations financially.
Yeah. And that whole recovery wasn't until the end of this crash. It wasn't until it started to perk its way back up in 85, 86. You're right.
Exactly.
So tons of causes that led to it. It wasn't just one thing. People love to say it was because E.T. was so bad. No, that was a factor, but it was it was more of a symptom than a cause. It was because of this backlog, because of this proliferation, because of the volume. So here we are, guys. We're all alive in 1982. We're all playing Atari.
Okay.
But we're all about 2 years off, each of us. So before we get out of this segment, we're talking about the causes of this crash. I want to know if you had any awareness that it was creeping up, that was happened. Was there anything happened at the stores or amongst your friends or anything? Did you at all see some kind of a change coming? I see Mo nodding. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. You saw cartridges in bargain bins.
Yeah.
You never saw that. You never, ever. They were behind the counter, behind glass, because kids would steal them so much.
That's right.
Yeah. You know? Now you see like this baskets of them.
They're the basket like, out in front in the mall outside of the store, like where they have the hoppy dogs now, you know, work out there. It was outside of the store for $5 a piece.
$10 or $5.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It was ridiculous. So I said, this is a problem.
Yeah. George, anything that percolates? You were a little younger, so maybe were you oblivious to the financial situation, or what did you think?
1,000%. Honest to goodness, you can quote me on this. I did not see this fucking coming at all. I was 11, 12 years old when this thing happened. I was just sitting there with my little thumbs on my little CX-40 joystick playing Pac-Man to my heart's content. And you got to remember, like we talked about in last week's episode, I was also more of an athletic child. So video games were only part of my day. They were not all of my day secondary, like some people. Sure. And so I got the things I wanted. I played them. My friends and I would come to my house or their house and we would play the different consoles, but it wasn't the whole thing of our lives. We were still young enough that that stuff just wasn't hitting our,
it was a part of play, not the focus, not a focal point.
Yeah.
I mean, it was certainly one of my focal points. I mean, we did a lot of playing outside and stuff that we've talked about on this show, but so I'm right in between you guys. And I certainly, looking back, I can see all the things happening. I remember seeing them. I remember the bargain bins, Mo. I remember that companies were like, well, wait a minute. They said that game was coming out. That was 2 years ago. What happened to that? You know, it started, but I just like, I wasn't old enough at that point to understand that businesses could collapse. I just thought, oh, they changed their mind or something. Now looking back, it's like, oh yeah, I was standing in the middle of the fire, but I didn't know the forest was on fire. I thought it was just a fire in front of me. And turns out I was living in the middle of it looking back and I'm like, oh yeah, I see all the evidence. I see all the signs. But as a kid, it was a positive impact because games were cheaper. cheaper. I got more games to play. Yeah, the quality was going down, but it was a quality drop with a quantity increase. So I kind of still had lots of fun. It wasn't until later that I looked back and saw why they got so cheap.
Mm-hmm. So to continue John's forest fire metaphor, Mo ran away screaming, calling for a fire truck. John understood there was a fire in front of him and stepped back a little bit, and I was roasting marshmallows.
Ooh, a fire. Didn't bother you at all.
Yep, sounds about right. Okay, so we saw what led up to this. We've talked about its causes. We get back from the break. We're going to talk about how it impacted the industry and the economy in general. We talked about it was not just here, but around the world. We're going to talk all about that as soon as we get back.
Hi, this is comedian and writer, and let's be honest, I do a lot of things. This is Dino Tripodis, the host of Whiskey Business, the podcast not so much about whiskey as it is one with whiskey. Yes, we drink and talk about whiskey, but we do so much more with so many interesting people. For example, we talk to comedians like Greg Warren.
You know, I don't want to brag, but let's just say I can walk into a Red Lobster and get whatever. You know, I think the pause right there is probably more important than the word.
Amazing athletes like boxing champion Buster Douglas.
When a fighter's down and he's looking for his mouthpiece instead of trying to get up.
That's when I knew it was over.
Yeah, yeah. Right?
And yes, Bigfoot chasers.
Do you believe in Bigfoot? And if so, does he really eat beef jerky?
The Bigfoot thing is people have seen these, and I've seen a lot of compelling evidence about it.
It's Whiskey Business with Dino Tripodis. Join us for what we call a good conversation with a good pour. You really can't ask for much more than that, can you, people? Check us out at WhiskeyBusinessPod.com, a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network.
Each episode of Gen X Grown Up has show notes loaded with links where you can learn more about our topics. And there's even more to see and hear over at GenXGrownUp.com.
I'd like the most popular home video game system ever.
Ah, the system you want is the Atari 2600.
That's so fast. I want a system that can play hundreds of games.
Oh, then what you want is the Atari 2600.
But I'd like the system that can also play educational games for my children.
Then what you want is the Atari 2600.
Fine, but I want a real low price.
Ooh, the Atari 2600 is priced incredibly low.
That's what I want.
The Atari 2600.
Now with its new exciting games at a new low price.
So we're now like mid-1983, the bubble has well and truly burst. It's a downward spiral that we're on until we get to the end of 85. We just talked about a couple of the impacts of the crash kind of in the last segment. We mentioned that games went in the bargain bin. And so people that previously couldn't afford games at the $35, $40 level, whatever they were, they could afford them at $5 or $10. I've talked to a lot of people who said, I didn't know there was a crash. I didn't get into games until 84 because they were finally cheap enough that I could get them. So you could say that's a positive impact on gamers, but not the industry in general. Now, I was looking on Atari Age, and you could go through, they have a database of every game ever released for any Atari console. And so speaking of the 2600, and I keep going back to that one because it's a commonality we all have and know, and is also the biggest. Right. They show in their database 158 different publishers developed for the Atari VCS.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And only 10% of all games published accounted for 75% of the revenue. So 90% of the games were trash or not selling. They were just being published. Yep. So yeah, that's
that's market saturation in statistical. 101. That's exactly what that is. Yeah.
Holy cow.
So companies started folding. So you have smaller developers like Apollo Games, US Games. They just went away. They went bankrupt and folded. And then to compound the problem, stores who now have their stock, who normally when it doesn't sell can return it to the company. Let's call the company. The number you've dialed is not in service at this time. They're not there. To buy back this stock. So now stores are eating it.
Yeah. I mean, you think about back then, remember when you would get a new game, whether it be for the Atari VCS or maybe a Commodore 64. I distinctly remember looking in the back of some of these manuals and seeing Joe Schmo wrote this game, write him at address blah, blah, and it would be his personal address,
his home address or something.
Yeah. Game especially manual, Activision. Yeah.
Right. That you could reach out to these people. That's how fly by night some of these publishers were. Like literally it was a post office box in Delaware and the company was gone as soon as they sold their stock out to Sears or Kmart or whoever was hawking these cartridges to, you know, the masses out there. It's it's crazy how it was completely unregulated. It was the wild west of business and video games coming together.
Yeah. And even some relatively successful makers of games like iMagic, like they made some games that are actually pretty decent.
Oh, yeah. Atlantis and Dragonfire. And
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Cosmic Arc. Yeah.
They were going to go public, decided not to, and then they went bankrupt because they just they just had to lose. They lost everything. I mean, imagine going from IPO one day and being excited to
gone,
shutting the doors.
What a roller coaster. Jesus.
Yeah.
Well, Activision's the biggest. They were the first. Mm-hmm. They saved their bacon by actually paying attention to the market. Atari didn't pay attention to the market.
Yeah.
Activision paid attention and they're like, you know what? Let's make computer games because computers were one of the main competitions. It's like they jumped on whatever boat was not currently going down and said, we'll do that. So they're bigger than they, well, did they just get sold? I think Microsoft just purchased them or something.
Yeah, I think
but
Microsoft
look,
just
they're
bought
still
them or something.
Extant. They're still making stuff.
Still around.
They have a reputation that's not awesome, but they're still alive and they started in 82.
To your point, they were four rock star developers and they knew their industry, right?
Right.
Better than probably anybody else on either side of the fence. But that story is okay. The story that everybody wants to talk about when we go through the 83 game crash is the one, John, I want to hear from you because you have done arguably one of my favorite videos on the icon of the 1983 game
crash.
Poster
child.
The Atari landfill with the ET cartridge that everybody knows and people swear up and down left, right, and center. You're one of the few people that actually went out and bought one of these things.
I did.
And at the time, it was just a rumor. Won an auction and has it in a frame and it smells like garbage.
It does.
I want to hear what your thoughts are on the Atari landfill as the icon of the game crash.
Yeah. Well, and it's fascinating. And you mentioned E.T., which is, you know, Mo, you said it, the poster child for the crash. People go, E.T., the worst game ever. They clearly never played any other games on the 2600. There's way worse.
Right. There were a lot
way
of worse games.
Way worse. It's way below expectations for that Christmas season, yes, but it's not the worst game ever. The Atari landfill, it started, you said it too, Mo, it started as a rumor. It was an urban legend.
Yeah,
did you hear that Atari buried a bunch of shit in a landfill? No, that's silly. Why would you do that? Well, we just talked about what happened in 82. They double produced what they needed. They made like 60 million. They needed like 30 million or whatever it was.
Right.
Whatever I said is half of what they made is
half
what they needed.
Too many. They made too many.
Way too many. So they not only had more than they could ship, they were getting returns because the games like E.T. were underperforming. People said, oh, they're not buying them or it's bad word of mouth.
Right.
So here Atari has these mountains of stock, of inventory. And it's not just E.T. It's every game. The problem is they couldn't move games. And so their options were A, slash the prices and ship them, therefore undermining the credibility of Atari as a powerhouse, because why is it on clearance? Or get rid of them in a way that people couldn't just go and grab them out of the trash. So they had already laid off 30% of their workers. They had already moved manufacturing out of the United States to Taiwan and Hong Kong, but now they had these empty warehouses of, and it, apparently it's illegal to burn stuff for insurance reasons. So what they chose to do was they hired a bunch of trucks and they hauled all their inventory, the surplus crap, buried it in a landfill in Alamogordo, New Mexico. Covered it with concrete so kids couldn't go out there and dig up Atari games. And just, that was it. That was it. So they didn't want to further devalue. They thought they could come out of this, right? Like, well, this is our livelihood. We don't want to devalue it. We're going to be in business for the long term. So when it comes out the other end, we don't have all this old stock. Well, they didn't come out the other end. They buried their mistakes. They buried their lack of being able to stay with their finger on the pulse of the industry. And ultimately, they buried themselves.
It's interesting that it was likely a financial decision by a bean counter, right?
Oh, yeah.
What are you talking about? You're talking about tons of stock, like you said, sitting in warehouses. What's the cost of that? Well, you've got the warehouse rental costs straight off the bat, right? The square footage cost on those warehouses was probably way crazier than any revenue they could have been bringing in, even in their projections 2 or 3 years down the road. They if they would have said to themselves, hey, let's just wait this out, let it reset for about a year or two, and then we'll have these cartridges and we can sell them as like nostalgic or blah, 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 or hey, remember this thing? It's back again, you know, trying to bring back the old to the new. And the bean counter said, we got to pay for warehouse space for 3 years? No, just bury the shit. It's cheaper. Put it in a truck, drive it over there. They're not going to fly it on the plane and just bury it somewhere close here that nobody will ever think to go.
It's way cheaper to just put a bullet in its head.
I mean, I used to work for a company that did manufacturing and stuff. And the guy told me, he says, you know, he had stuff. He says, I wish I could just take it out in the parking lot and burn it.
Right.
Because not only is it, it's taking up space that I could have something that sells in.
There you go.
Yep. Yep.
You know, instead of sitting there. So it definitely was, I think the burying it idea, I mean, it's one way to cure your overstock problem. That's for sure. I mean, it totally just gets rid of it.
It did. Isn't it sad too? Like, most of this was brand new stock, still sealed in shrink wrap. Look, I'd love to go back in time and pay for that warehouse so that I would have all this new stock today. Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah.
You never know. You never know. They say the full effects of this crash weren't really felt until 85. And it was that time analysts doubted the long-term viability of the industry. Mm-hmm. Full stop, period. They said, look, we tried it. Video games aren't a thing anybody wants. It's not going to be a thing any longer. Now, again, we know how that turned out, but it looked that bleak.
Well, I mean, it dropped. You dropped 97% or something crazy.
97%.
I mean,
right? What are the chances of it going back to that level?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'd said earlier that while it's mostly known as the North American crash, here's the thing. Ripples of it were felt worldwide. The estimated $42 billion market in 1982, including arcade, console, and computer games, worldwide had dropped to $14 billion by 85.
Wow.
That's well
beyond. Two-thirds.
The U.S. was only $3.2 billion of that. So two-thirds. Slashed. So,
wow.
Yeah, it was just a North American thing. Yeah, we caused it. Yeah, Atari was the main culprit. But it's far from a North American Atari thing. Yeah, it's got to be E.T. No.
All right. So we've talked a lot at the end of each one of these segments so far, and we've given ourselves a question. I came up with one just as we were discussing this. So I'm going to throw this one at you guys. You haven't had any chance to prepare.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. But the market has crashed. We're not getting any new stuff, right? So I'm wondering what you guys did instead of playing new video games.
Oh, that's an easy one for me. I could jump into it.
Yeah.
Dungeons and Dragons.
Okay. Dungeons and Dragons.
D&D.
Yeah.
There you go.
Big role-playing game. That was actually big even when the stuff was still hot, because we just played a little bit of 2600. But as time went on, we wound up playing more D&D and a lot less arcade.
Gotcha.
Console games.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about you, John?
I played some D&D, but it was a lot of board games, certainly.
Okay.
Lots of board games, a lot of Monopoly, stuff like that. Also, that was 82, 83 was also kind of the rise of the electronic board game that kind of gave me that video game feel.
Oh, right.
Like Stop Thief and things like that that had a little calculator type gadget with it. Dark Tower. Because I love the nerdy kind of computery thing, and companies were looking ways to merge those. So fewer video games are out. I mean, again, I didn't realize at the time, but now looking back, I shifted to like computerized or computery board games became a big thing for me. What about you? Did you just go outside and play ball? What'd you do, George?
Mostly. I did. I was one of the Commodore 64 converts. So I shifted from consoles to C64. So it was a combination of that and doing more activities outside, which was my, proclivity anyway. So for me, the crash wasn't a noticeable thing like it was for you guys. I mean, I just did something different. And that's why I thought it was an interesting question, because everybody had a different perspective depending upon what age they were at at that point and their involvement in video games.
It's funny you bring that up, because when I was a kid, I had to write a story on depression, and we had to interview a relative that lived through the depression. Okay, it's one of those things. So I went to talk to my grandmother. She had no idea there was a depression. She lived on a farm.
Right?
It didn't apply to me.
Completely self-sufficient. Yeah, they're like, she had a lot more kids who came by, but I didn't know there was depression.
Huh.
Right?
Yeah, it's all about perspective, isn't it? All about perspective.
Mm-hmm. And a very short report.
You've got questions, we've got answers. Business leadership, ownership, and sales can be challenging. Tune into the Accelerate Your Business Growth podcast to learn from the world's experts. Join me, your host, Diane Helbig, as I chat with people who have expertise in various areas of business. You'll enjoy the lively conversations that are focused on providing you with the ideas, tips, and suggestions you need to realize greater success. Get what you need for your business when you need it from the people who have the answers. Accelerate Your Business Growth is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network and is available on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
If you're a diehard Gen X grown-up, you can pledge your support by clicking Join on YouTube or by becoming a patron at genxgrownup.com/Patreon.
The fun is back! Oh, yes, siree. It's the 2600 from Atari. It's the video system with classics galore, from Space Invaders to Cars That Roar. A real hip joystick controls the screen. Solaris is hot and Midnight Magic's mean. And one more thing, it's got a special low price, under $50.
$50?
Now, isn't that nice? The fun is back. Oh, yes, siree. It's the 2600 from Atari.
So it was a dark, dark time for console games back then in the early and mid 80s. But there was some light in the horizon, right? Particularly one console came back and I would say single-handedly revitalized the entire industry, right?
Absolutely.
And that was the NES. Like, who knew? I mean, people probably thought they were crazy for jumping back into that.
And they were crazy to bring in the North American market.
But I think they saw the reason why it crashed and they took steps to not repeat those same problems.
Well, there you go. That's right. I mean, so in Japan, they already had the Famicom, which is what the Nintendo Entertainment System is. And it was doing fine over there. And like, we would like to get it into the market. But North American stores said, ha ha ha, fool me once or twice or five times, shame on you. Fool me a 20th time, shame on me. I'm not doing that again, right? They'd lost all that money. And Nintendo first, as you said, Mo, they were smart to go, hey, this isn't a video game. It's an entertainment system. Look, it's got a little robot. It's got a little light gun. it's like a little computer. It's like a board game that hooks up to your TV. It was a Trojan horse of a home console.
Sure. Yeah.
They tricked companies, stores, industry into, oh, this isn't a video game. We can try it. And then, look, we had had nothing new in North America for 3 years. And last we remember was ColecoVision and Atari, and it all died. And the NES was a huge step in quality of the games.
Oh, yeah.
Just baseline capability of the hardware.
Yeah. The resolution and sounds and everything was amazing.
One thing to note, if you've watched any of those documentaries we talked about earlier, the games that made America or blah, 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 whatever you want to see.
Yeah, Toys That Made Us, whatever.
A guerrilla marketing campaign, especially Mo in your neck of the woods there in New York. Nintendo of America actually went around to the stores on foot, carrying consoles to these stores and begging them to put them on the shelves for the holiday season, I think it was, Christmas 85, something like that. But they were like, this is not a video game. Like, to John's point, this is an entertainment system. It's got a robot. Kids will get entertainment and educational value out of this thing, and it will sell. They were literally having to be salesmen of what is now arguably the largest name in video game history.
That sells itself.
The Nintendo Entertainment System. I mean, people looking back on this now go, why? Why would they have to convince people? But at that point, it was their name was mud, so to speak. I mean, it's just crazy that they had to go through those links and did what they did.
Yeah.
They had to beg, borrow, and steal to get into the stores. You're right.
Yeah.
The smarter thing that they did, and you alluded to a little bit, Mo, was they learned from the crash that we had here. And they're like, what caused it? They looked and they analyzed what were the contributing factors.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the big ones that we talked about was all these third-party developers making all these games with no sort of quality control.
Mm-hmm.
You look at a Nintendo box and it has that seal of Nintendo quality.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's on damn near every cartridge. What they did was they said, hey,
I think it's on everyone.
Third-party developers, we love you. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to authorize 2 games you can release for our cartridge per year, period.
Right.
The game won't work unless you buy this chip from us. The chip goes in your cartridge. The chip has to talk to the chip on the console. If it's not there, it won't work. Furthermore, when you release your 2, you better be damn well sure they're your very best because you're not going to get another 2 until next year.
Mm-hmm.
And so now companies were like, whoa, 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 we can't just shit out games. We got to work hard and make them good because we just get 2 a year.
And yet still, 7-Up released Cool Spot. I don't know how that happened.
Well, I think that company didn't care about doing any more after that.
Right.
It was a promotion. They were fine with 1 that year.
That's not to say there aren't turds on the Nintendo Entertainment System or there aren't turds today. But what there aren't are 50 or 60 different platforms and 50 or 60 different third-party developers putting out 20 or 30 games a year. That didn't happen anymore. No. Now, when you got a Nintendo game, you're like, okay, they cost $40, but it's got the seal of quality on it. It's going to be good. Nintendo says it is. And by and large, they were.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that seal really meant that. I mean, because they actually looked at these games. I mean, they didn't just like slap that thing on there. Mm-hmm. They actually really looked at the games and made sure that the quality
Apple
was
up. Store thing, the iPhone's Apple Store did not develop this thought.
No.
Yeah, this was right. not the original thing. Nintendo.
Yeah, that walled garden of you can only sell it if you go through us kind of thing, that started with Nintendo. As far as I know, electronics, certainly.
Yeah, for sure. And see, like you said, John, it made the games, like you knew that any game you bought was at least going to be a certain level of quality. Now, you may not like the game.
Customer confidence.
Yeah.
Yeah. We just talked about that. Fixing all the problems. Proliferation of stuff. There's not any more games in town. Quality problems. Now we're only putting out quality stuff. Market confusion. It's very simple now. There's just us.
Well, there's one other factor to consider as well, right? You talk about that quality. Well, that quality's got to compare to something. Their baseline is Super Mario Brothers, right? The genius of that game was not just in how good it was. It was that it was hand-selected to be the representation of what that system could do. Mm-hmm. And every time you saw that quality stamp on a cartridge after that, that's what you compared it to. Hey, if this thing says the same as Mario Brothers, it's going to be at least as good as that. I'm willing to spend my $30 or $40.
That's a hell of a baseline.
Yeah.
Right?
And also, don't forget, I mean, Nintendo advertised the crap out of these on TV. I mean, I remember just seeing the commercials for Nintendo's just everywhere. They planted that seed in every kid's brain that you had to get one of these.
Yeah.
Because they spent a fortune on that advertising. I'm saying it worked. It definitely worked.
I mean, there's another system that came into play around that same time period too that allowed the systems to get into more hands for a smaller amount of money. Don't forget, video games were also at video rental houses.
Oh, that's right. That it just kind of started popping up along with VHS and Beta, of course.
Because not every mother and father could afford an NES, but for $10 for 3 days, you could go rent the system, rent another game for $5, and your kid felt like you just gave him the best gift in the world for 3 days. And then he could move on to something else because his mood changed or whatever. And then a 2 week period later, you could give another $15 and give him that same feeling again with a different game. It's a brilliant strategy that Nintendo didn't come up with, but it still helped drive the industry forward.
I remember renting those consoles too. It's like it came in a big black nuclear football satchel.
Exactly.
To keep from dropping it and damaging it. And it was huge. And like the console didn't even come out of the box.
And you couldn't unlock it. Only the little, front flap of the NES was usable.
Yep. Yeah, it was latched in that thing. It was like a boot on your car, but on this console.
Right.
And then, or if you had the console, George, you could just go and rent the game. Don't spend $40.
Just the game.
Yeah. Just $3 or $4 or $5 to rent the game for 3 days or something.
Test it out first before you decide.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
That's right.
Because now it was a risk-free way of seeing if you liked it.
Yeah.
Take some of that risk out. You're eliminating all the factors that led to the crash. So here we are coming out the back end. So here we are now. 40 years on from the inception of the crash, how are video games now? The industry of video games, I'm talking across, computers and consoles and everything, as an industry, is larger than movies and television revenue combined.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. I would not have thought that. I would
it's
have
the
thought
number
movies.
One entertainment
in industry, whatever.
Yeah. Industry.
Yeah, that's why you see people spend 4 years on a game. That's why the Grand Theft Auto 6 trailer had 100 million views in 36 hours, and it's still 2 years away. It's because
it's 2 years away. Oh my God.
Yeah, there's enough consumer confidence and trust in the industry now that it's an absolute powerhouse worldwide, and it almost died 40 years ago.
Wow.
Almost just by the breath. So to get us to that place that it's the biggest industry, entertainment industry in the world, at some point, all three of us probably got back into video gaming and consoles. So to end the show, what was your re-entry into, we had the drop off, we went to Dungeons and Dragons, we went to play in Ball Outside. George, let's start with you. When did you turn back around and come back into home video gaming?
I probably had the latest re-entry of all three of us. So 2000 or 2001, I can't remember exactly which year.
Wow. Yeah.
When I met Grace and we were getting married, she had a Sega system. No, I guess I did have the Sega Dreamcast.
Yeah. Oh,
okay. So before I met Grace, okay. I keep forgetting about that little system because I only had a couple of games on it and it really just sat on a shelf. I still have it. The Sega Dreamcast. Okay. Yeah, that was the next system I got back into. I didn't have the Nintendos, either the NES or the Super Nintendo, mm-hmm. but the Sega Dreamcast I had, and I played that Shenmue. That was the game on that system that I loved. Yeah. There were three sports games, the first of the 2K stuff, I think it was. But I guess that was the first system I got back into with was the Sega Dreamcast.
Yeah. Well, for me, it was in 1991. I was in college and I was addicted to Street Fighter II. And there was a version of Street Fighter II on the Super Nintendo. And I realized it's so good. It was so close to the arcade. It was amazing. I realized that if I spent the money to buy a Super Nintendo secondhand, I would actually save money. I was regularly spending $10 a weekend on Street Fighter II regularly. And George, all that money siphoning through that damn little putt-putt video game course back behind that old mall.
Right.
That's where I went and bought $10 worth of tokens every Saturday.
Yep.
But I bought a Super Nintendo in 1991, and that's all I bought it for, was to play Street Fighter II, and loved it. And then, of course, I picked up more things over time. But that was my reentry. I was in college and trying to save money on playing that. What about you, Mark?
Yeah, I was a little bit later too coming back into it. I think my first one I got was a GameCube.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Wow.
And I actually got it mostly for my kids.
So not even an N64?
Nope. Never had an N64.
Nope. Wow.
Because again, I think it might be because of our age differences too, but I was married at that point. I was, trying to do the whole adulting thing.
That's for the birds.
What a huge mistake it was. But then, because the GameCube came out in the late 90s, if I'm not mistaken, right?
96, I think. Feels right.
Probably around there.
There was a game that my kids wanted to play on it. And I got it. I think I probably got like 97, somewhere around there. But
did
that's
get you back in, or did you play anything on it? When did you personally?
Once I bought it, then I started playing it.
Okay. So once you had it at the house, so it was a gateway drug.
It was a gateway. Because then it went to the Xbox 360 and blah, blah,
blah. It's actually later than that. I had to go look it up because the GameCube was the one I was thinking that I first got back into when Grace and I got married. 2001's when the GameCube
came. Really? I thought that was late 90s. Okay.
Yeah. Dang. No, actually, that's about right. Because then my kids would be, Rachel would have been 9. So that was what the age I was buying it for them.
We all played our part in resurrecting. We didn't buy the NES because we're that bridge gap. I was too old. I was in high school. I would say my girlfriend's little brother had an NES. I never did, but I played his sometimes. That was all because I was into computers like you were, George. It was whatever the next thing was. We did our part in resurrecting the industry. So pat ourselves on the back. Good job. This is a big topic. Thank you guys for your help researching it. It's a lot to look into and talk about. There's so many numbers and people are still today talking about what caused it. How could it have been avoided? All that. It's a philosophical debate for the ages, but for us, I'm just happy that it came back. So here we are in the future, enjoying video games once again. Before we get out of this show, as always, I want to take just a second to thank all of the fantastic human beings who voluntarily support us with just a few dollars a month over on Patreon. You guys literally keep the show going. You keep us continuing to do what we do. Something we're giving away for free, and you're like, we want to support you, help you pay the bills, pay for the Zencaster when we record it, pay for the everything that it costs us to get stuff done. If you would like to help these people keep Gen X Grown Up a viable media outlet, it's easy. For as little as $1 a month, head over to patreon.com/GenXGrownUp. Tick a few boxes, log in, make up a password, help us out. We're infinitely grateful if you do, and super grateful to those of you that continue to support us today.
Yes. Avoid the Gen X Grown Up crash of 2023 or whatever.
Oh my goodness. Oversaturation.
That means in 40 years, somebody would be doing a podcast of that.
40 years ago, Gen X Grown Up was on the precipice of greatness when all the Patreon logged off. Oh, I don't want to do that podcast. Thank you so much to all of you that do support us over there. That is going to wrap it up for this Backtrack edition of our show. Don't worry, we'll be back in 2 weeks with another one. Next week is a standard edition of our show. Until then, I'm John. George, thank you so much for being here.
Yes, sir.
Mo, you know I appreciate you.
Always fun, man.
Fourth listener, it's you. We all appreciate most of all, though, and we'll talk to you again next time. Bye-bye.
See you guys.
Take care, everybody.
Gen X Grown Up is a member of the Evergreen Podcast family. Learn more at evergreenpodcasts.com. No more washy shows till sunrise. Unacceptable for grown-ups. Your dinner cannot just be french fries. Basically, life sucks as a grown-up.
Yeah, I'm good on the promo.
I gave George more to say. Because he looked like he wanted to talk.
He does. He always looks
like it's usually a safe bet.
Yeah. I never shut up.
Science, science, science! Science, science! Hello, podcast fans. Want to get weird with us? Come check out the Mad Scientist Podcast. We are a weekly show that looks at the history, philosophy, and hard facts behind your biggest paranormal questions.
Did the government really pay for a psychic spy program?
Yes!
Is it true that surgery got its start in grave robbing?
Yes!
Can a roller coaster really kill you?
Legally, we can't say so for sure, but sometimes, yes! Mm. Join myself, Chris Cogswell, and my co-host, Marie Mayhew, as we examine the science, philosophy, and history behind the strange and unusual. All to discover what's possible and plausible versus what's, well, just made up. Check us out wherever you find your favorite podcasts. The Mad Scientist Podcast.